All right, what about you? What do you think about that? I won't give up. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm Michael Slate. And we're coming at you in the wake of this just horrendous speech and actions and dramatic escalation of the war in Afghanistan. America's romping all over the world, stomping all over the world. And I felt that the Giallo Biafra song from his band, the Guantanamo School of Medicine, the name of the song is I Won't Give Up, but the album is The Audacity of Hype. And it's a really powerful album. And I'm really glad to see that Giallo is actually taking this stand. It's kind of a very important thing. We have a very good show lined up today. In the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Mike Gray, who was the producer and one of the filmmakers of the murder of Fred Hampton. We're also going to be talking with Larry Everest, a reporter for Revolution Newspaper and the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. We'll be talking with Larry about the Obama speech and about the escalation of the war, what's behind it, what's going on there. And first, I'm really happy to open up with this guest, James Loewen, who's the author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. As much as I thought I knew a lot about history and lies and all this other stuff, this was a book that really helped me understand quite a bit. And it's called Lies My Teacher Told Me, Everything Your American History Textbook Got Wrong. He also wrote Lies Across America, What Our Historic Sites Got Wrong, which I really loved too, because I used to love looking at these signs and thinking, where the hell did that come from? In fact, where I grew up was a small part of Southwest Philly. And for some reason, they kept saying that Daniel Boone was a big figure in that territory. And I don't even know if that's true, but it just always both sickened me and amazed me. We last had Jim Loewen on for his book, Sundown Towns, which was a very fascinating interview, a very fascinating book. And he's back now with a brand new book, Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm glad to be with you.
You make a point that history and social studies, and this is actually, I think for a lot of people, this is something that people might have some inkling of, but I think generally it's also kind of shocking, because you make the point in the beginning of your book that history and social studies, as usually taught, especially before college, can hinder instead of build up a student's understanding of how the world works. And in fact, it makes them not smarter, but stupider.
It does. That's right.
Well, how?
Well, I first consider the following point. If you look around the world in 1892, and of course I pick 1892 on purpose, that was the 400th anniversary of the great Christopher Columbus's expedition, and it was a big celebration in the U.S., partly because Columbus, in a way, emulated him. We both went west. We both kind of trampled on the native people we saw, and we both brought civilization to a barren, almost virgin continent, or so the textbooks put it. Okay, you look around the world in 1892, and white folks run it. There's really only two important nations that are not controlled by white folks, and that would be, I think, Japan and Ethiopia. Even China is under the thumb of Germany and the U.S. and Japan, actually, to some extent, and Great Britain and France. Of course, India is, and all of the Western Hemisphere, and so on. Now, that's the most profound event, that process, or whatever you want to call it. It's more than one single event, I suppose. But it's the most profound happening in world history in the last 500 years. Okay, the question to be asked then is, why? Why did Europe and extensions of Europe conquer the world and even rule it, run the darn place? That question I never got asked in my K-12 experience. I never got asked in my 4 years of college. I never got asked in my 4 years of graduate school. If you don't get it asked, you don't get it answered. And if you don't get it answered, there's a little vacuum, I think, up in the synapses there. And into that vacuum, which nature abhors, I think the following short sentence sneaks in. White folks ran the whole world because they're better, because they're smarter. And you don't even have to be white to believe that, or at least to believe it a little bit. That's maybe the most important single topic, then, that history should deal with, because white dominance of the world in 1892, and it continues to a considerable extent to this day, but of course not as much, is incredibly important, and it is historically caused. So it can be answered historically and not genetically, and we don't answer it. We don't even address it. So that's just one example of how history as taught in K-12 lets us down, how terrible it is.
That's one example I wanted to get into a little bit later, because there's so much packed into that chapter that you have there. And I think it is. It's a really critical question. As you mentioned, Jared Diamond has tried to deal with about why certain civilizations.
Jared Diamond does try to
deal
with
it. Right.
We got to give him credit for that.
He really
does. I think that's the key question he's trying to ask in his famous book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Now, but before we get into that exact example, let's go through a couple of these things, because it's
sure.
In addition to making students dumber And really, it does even worse. I mean, it doesn't equip them to know the world. And if you don't know the world, you can't change it by any means.
And it certainly doesn't equip them to change it.
Right, exactly. And it's very interesting because most people are familiar by now with the idea that, well, you know, the students in America are just, they're dumb as a block of wood in relation to science and math and in comparison with people in other countries. But you make a point that actually history is one of the places where this sort of lack of knowledge, lack of understanding is most pronounced in the American educational system.
Yeah, the famous NAEP, National Assessment of Educational Progress. These are precisely the folks that are always finding us, you know, way behind Korea in math and way behind everybody in science and so on. They actually say concluded about 4 years ago that we're even way behinder in history. Our level of competence, that is, high school students' level of competence in history, is the lowest of all. And we didn't even need them to tell us that, because if you just go to college and talk with any college, any university, and you talk with a faculty in, say, math, they're perfectly happy if you had more math in high school. They'll put you in advanced calculus instead of regular calculus. They'll give you a test first to make sure you actually learn the stuff, but then they're happy with you. The Shakespeare teacher, if he or she finds out that you had King Lear as well as, say, Romeo and Juliet, which everybody gets, well, they're not going to put you in advanced Shakespeare, but they're perfectly happy with you because, after all, you've read the original play, you've thought about it. It may not be the exact same interpretation as your college teacher gives you, but you know, that's good. But this is not the case in history. In history, well, a friend of mine teaches the survey course at the University of Vermont, a huge course, of course. He calls it Iconoclasm 1 and 2 because he says he has to break the icons, break the dead wrong images that you get from your high school and pre-high school, your K-12 history lessons. He would rather teach foreign students who either don't know anything or actually who get some halfway decent instruction in American history, depending on what country they're in.
You know, I want to remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with James Lowen, the author of Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. Now, Jim, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about is along the lines of what we're talking about, you also make the point that the achievement gap, which is something that people have studied a lot in many different subject areas, and they've really documented the biases and the differences between groupings of people, but you make a point that that achievement gap, not just the overall knowledge of history generally, but the achievement gap between the haves and have-nots is most pronounced, the American educational system is most pronounced in history.
That's right. And I think there's reasons for that. We mean, of course, the gap between, say, blacks and whites, between Native Americans and European Americans, between rich folks and poor folks. And the gap is biggest in history or social studies. Why? Well, it can't be because history is harder than, say, Faulkner, or harder than trigonometry. I think it's because the way it's typically taught has this basic underlying storyline. Namely, we started out great and we've been getting better ever since, kind of automatically, you know? I mean, you people, that is what my fifth grade teacher always used to call us, that you people should vote, you know, but other than that, that's kind of all you have to do because we started out great and we're getting better automatically. Well, what does that do if your group ain't so great, you know, if your group's down on the bottom, or if your family, let's say you're a poor white family? Thanksgiving kind of exemplifies this. I mean, it's a fine holiday. I like the food. I like the fellowship. But in Thanksgiving time, we also do actually, as a nation and as families, we thank God for our blessings. Now, what's the matter with that? Well, let me just say it's not a Swedish perspective. You know, it's not a Kenyan perspective that the United States is the dominant military on the planet, the dominant economy on the planet, and in many ways the dominant culture on the planet because God ordained it. And so I think there's an ethnocentrism built into the textbooks in American history and the way most people teach American history that off-puts everybody but the maybe white male upper middle class and upper class elite. And even those folks are bored to tears by it.
You make a big point around, and this is tied in with the factor of critical thinking and how essential history is to critical thinking. And you make a big point about historiography and how that's one of the most vital, most important things that students
I wish every American knew that word. And, you know, I've asked big groups of teachers, and maybe 5% know the word. I mean history teachers. So I know that if I ask, say, the AFL-CIO or if I ask the ACLU or whatever group I might ask, even 5% wouldn't know it. Historiography means, of course, the study of history, but not in the sense of, oh, geez, I'm way behind, I got to do historiography this weekend, but rather the writing of history. How is it affected by the social position of the people who wrote it. Who wrote this textbook? When did they write it? How has it changed over time? Who didn't write this book? Or even better, this historical marker. My very favorite way of teaching historiography, oh gosh, I have two favorite ways. Well, let me mention a different one than I was going to mention. This is the 150th anniversary of John Brown's execution. And we can see historiography in the treatment of John Brown in the same textbook over time. And it's just a great way that you can get students doing it, too. I suggest that teachers should collect old history textbooks. They're the cheapest things in used bookstores. Matter of fact, a lot of used bookstores won't even carry them because there's almost no demand. So you can quickly build up 20 or 30 of them for an expenditure of like $20 or $30. And if you just look at the same book, and I'm thinking in particular of the bestseller Rise of the American Nation, which then became Triumph of the American Nation after we lost the war in Vietnam, and it's still in print under the name Holt American Nation today. If you look at what it said about John Brown over time, it's just fascinating. I'll give you just one sentence. 1951 and also 1961 called his escapade at Harper's Ferry, quote, a wild plan certain to fail. Same book, 1981, a bold plan almost certain to fail. Now, that's about 13 cents worth of typography. You know, you change WI to BO and you add the word almost, and you can hear John Brown getting a little more sane over time. And so it turns out, if you think about it, well, I asked a bunch of fifth graders. I taught them the word historiography, and I asked them, what happened to John Brown between 1951 and 1981? They said, correctly, nothing. I said, what happened in American society between those two dates that might explain this? And like a flash, they said, the Civil Rights Movement, and they're right. And suddenly you realize that when you write about John Brown helps determine what you write about John Brown. And that makes you twice as smart when you're going to see a historical marker or a historic site or whatever.
That was one thing that fascinated me. I was talking with a friend about it last night. The idea that this idea that history changes. Think about how history actually changes and what that has to do with this point about the particular importance of critical thinking. Because even now, you know, one of the points you make in your book is that a lot of times history in the U.S. justifies the American past and doesn't analyze it.
That's right.
You know, and that's an extremely dangerous situation to be in.
Well, it makes us stupider again. It makes us stupider about the U.S. It makes us less likely to critique, for example, either what you mentioned at the beginning of the program, either of our two current wars, you know?
Exactly. Now, Jim, I wanted to get back to the point that you were talking about of the how Europe won or why did Europe win. And one of the things that came up in there that fascinated me was, and it comes up in a number of spots in the book. For listeners, you have six chapters in the end that actually show, that illustrate all the points that you've been making in the first part of the book. And in this one in particular, you have this point where you show all the lies that were told about the past, like, for instance, Columbus and the flat earth view.
Yeah.
And also, I thought, because you were talking about America being the center of ethnocentrism in the world, and then you have this whole point about Europe, and I thought that was a funny idea that Europe, in terms of how people think, that Europe is listed as a continent.
Yeah, it's not a continent, is it? It's a peninsula,
yeah.
Actually. And it's interesting because it's the continent. That is, we have the term continental cuisine, right? Or continental breakfast or whatever. And wouldn't it be interesting if we started calling that a peninsular breakfast? Even in America, we denote everything from, maybe let's say from about Rome or maybe Geneva. So we say it's the Near East. Okay. It's not the Near East from you guys. You know, it's shorter for you guys to get to Iraq, let's say, by going west. So why isn't it the kind of far west? Well, we're measuring it from Rome, and we don't even realize it.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's very important, actually. One thing I want to end with this, Jim. There's a quote in your book where you quote James Agee, and it says, in every child who is born under no matter what circumstances and of no matter what parents, the potentiality of the human race is born again.
Yeah.
What does that have to do with what drives you and what's behind this book?
I'm almost tearing up just because you said that. That's my very favorite book in all the world. It's a book called Let Us Now Praise Famous Men, about poor people in Alabama, and among other things, it's about why they're poor. And I think in the United States in particular, we blame people for being poor. It's one of the reasons why we can't even pass health care. You know, it's their own damn fault if they don't have it. No other industrialized nation has health care, anything like that, ours, and we end up spending, a higher percentage of our GDP on it and getting less results, so it's not even rational. So I think what we have to do is we have to expect the heck out of every child that's born. We have to expect the heck out of the kindergartner, out of the 11th grader who hasn't done much up until now, and we have to get him or her to buy into expecting the heck. out of himself or herself. And that's part of what Teaching What Really Happened is all about as well.
Jim, a very valuable book. Thanks for writing it. Thanks for getting it out there. And thanks for being on the show, man.
I'm happy to be there, and I really hope your listeners will get this book, read it, keep it nice, and then give it to the history teacher they had in high school who didn't teach them none of this stuff.
Very good
that
idea.
That would improve the world.
Very good idea, Jim. Thanks again, right, man. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've been talking with James Loewen. His new book is Teaching What Really Happened, How to Avoid the Tyranny of Textbooks and Get Students Excited About Doing History. If you want to know the world and change the world, you should be reading this book, See What You Don't Know. That's a point that we're going to be making continuously throughout this show today is, boy, if ever the world cried out for really radical change, it's these days. It's these days very much. So we're going to take a quick break and be right back with Larry Everest. Welcome back. That's Outer National with Sir No Sir. And that, actually, they have a new music video on YouTube. Search on YouTube for Outer National and Sir No Sir. You'll get this video, and it's really worth checking out. And listeners to this show might recall that we had Outer National live in studio back a few months ago in the summer, and they did a really fantastic set there. And this is just incredible. And I think it's a song for the times, actually. It's a song that people need to be looking at, especially given what we're going into these days and what we've been in, but especially what we're going into. A brilliant band, outernational.net. You can go to that, just catch up with them, but definitely check out this song. All right, Larry Everest, reporter for Revolution Newspaper and author of Oil, Power, and Empire, A Rock in the U.S. Global Agenda. And Larry is a frequent guest on this show, although it's been a while since we've had him on. I'm really pleased to welcome him back because he's on there and he's going to be talking about a really enraging subject. Larry, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Good to be with you.
Well, let's jump into this, man, because I know we've talked since this speech happened, and there's so much going on here. What's your overall take on Obama's speech? I mean, I watched it. It's interesting. I watched it in almost every sentence. First, my mouth would just hang open, and then you just got angrier and angrier. And the take on it, and when you came out of it, and you're watching this, and you just see, you can see this thing morphing, just a jingoistic, chauvinistic, warmongering speech that really kind of put, I think, for all those people who may have drunk the Obamalade for a while or whatever, for all those people, it had to raise some serious questions. But even more importantly, for the people of the world, it's something that represents a tremendous, tremendous attack. And I'd like to get your take on the speech overall first.
Well, there was a lot packed into that speech. I mean, to me, the core of it, the core message is we are all Americans. We need to unite. We need to unite to defend America. And he's trying to drum home this false narrative of the we. In other words, when he talks about we and America, he's talking about the interests of the imperialist system and the imperialist ruling class. He is not talking about the interests of humanity, certainly not the interests of the people of humanity, and certainly not the even the interests of the people in this country. And that's a very deadly and horrific framework that we've seen over the last 8 years has justified one atrocity after another, protecting America. And he's telling the truth in the sense that when he says protect America, he's talking about protecting the interests of American imperialism and the American empire. And those interests are radically antagonistic to the interests of people in Afghanistan, people in Iran, people all across the world, and people here.
Let's jump into this, because I think actually, you know, you make a point about this speech. And I think, you know, in terms of what you're saying about the presentation of America and the Eber people, this whole thing of we're coming together around this. And you make the point about this narrative that Obama has developed. And I know in talking with you, you've made the point that actually one of the things that struck you is that this is a big lie. It's a total lie. Let's talk about some of the examples in the speech that he raised, the narrative of why the U.S. is there, what it's doing. What are the lies?
Yeah, let's get into that. And it's a perfect segue off your last segment about the lies my teacher told me. But one of the first things that struck me was Obama says, we didn't ask for this war. In other words, the United States did nothing to provoke or prompt an attack like September 11th. And then he goes on to talk about why the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were in Afghanistan. And he says it was a product of the country being ravaged by years of Soviet occupation and civil war. Well, why was Afghanistan ravaged? Afghanistan was ravaged because the United States was in a bitter contention with the Soviet Union, which was an empire then in the 1980s. It called itself a communist state, but it was an imperialist empire. They were in a bitter rivalry, and the U.S. actually helped provoke this reactionary invasion from the Soviet Union. And then once the Soviet Union came in, and by the way, the Soviets installed a government in Kabul that looks wonderful in comparison to what the United States put in place there with a Karzai regime. But be that as it may, once the Soviets were in, the United States worked to fuel, extend, and make the war even more violent and destructive by funneling $3 billion of aid to Islamic jihadists. This is where Osama bin Laden and the seeds of the Taliban got their start. And the whole global jihadist movement was birthed into a significant degree. I'm not going to reduce it to that. But to a significant degree was birthed thanks to the United States, the Pakistani intelligence, and the Saudis, all U.S. allies. So first of all, the U.S. bears enormous responsibility, and it's not simply, as Obama said, because after that war, the United States turned its attention elsewhere. This is just one example of how the United States imperialism in many ways has actually fueled the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, which is a reactionary trend, does not offer any hope for the people of the world. But the United States in many ways is responsible for fueling this. And the more the United States goes into a place like Afghanistan, as we've seen the last 8 years, the more that's going to be fueled. So that was one thing.
Let me interject something here for a moment, and I want to remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and this is The Michael Slate Show. And I'm talking today with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper. We're talking about the dramatic escalation, the criminal escalation of the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Now, Larry, I wanted to ask you a couple of other questions. There's a number of lies that you point to, but there's actually something very, very important that we not forget about. It's actually at the forefront of all of this. And people here, there is a point that's been raised many times, and especially by Revolution Newspaper, that people here need to stop thinking like Americans and start thinking about humanity. And the impact, what this is actually going to mean, because when I'm watching Obama give this speech, I'm looking at it and it's like that morphing between Bush and Obama. And while Obama has a different role, generally, this thing, there was actually a tremendous amount of similarities. And this invasion is actually going to mean something very horrific for the people of Afghanistan. 30,000 more U.S. troops, possibly, as you've said, maybe tens of thousands of NATO troops. All of these things, let's talk a little bit about what that's going to mean for the people of Afghanistan so people can be clear.
Well, that's important. I mean, first, this is going to bring U.S. troops up to 100,000. There are another 70,000 military contractors. There are another 40,000 and soon to be perhaps 50,000 troops. I mean, we're getting up to 200,000 people. And remember, one of the things that has happened, and this is very, very hidden from people, is this is an extremely violent war against the people of Afghanistan. I mean, there have been a series of airstrikes that have killed many, many civilians. When the U.S. troops roll through these various villages and so on, they're detaining people. They're sending them to so-called black sites and torture centers like Bagram. Many civilians are being killed. The one estimate I saw was 8,000 during the course of the war. We have drone strikes in Pakistan that are going to be escalated. There was a very important exposure in the New Yorker. It took something like 15 or 16 attacks that killed 270 people in order to get one suspected Taliban leader. There was a recent report about, and remember, the United States is now applauding Pakistan for the fact that its military is quote-unquote taking on the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Waziristan and in the Swat Valley. Well, a recent article in the Times exposed that, look, there were just massive revenge killings by the Pakistani military, bodies littering the street, people's children being brought back to them, tortured to death. I mean, this is the kind of brutality that's going to be inflicted. And in addition to that, I mean, Afghanistan remains one of the most impoverished countries in the world. Nearly half of the people are food insecure, in other words, on the brink of hunger, even starvation, desperate, desperate living conditions, which have all been made worse by the war. So this is going to be a continuing nightmare for people in Afghanistan and in Pakistan. And I just want to say, too, that one of the things the U.S. does, and Obama is going to even more narrowly focus on this, is support the same sort of reactionary forces and social relations, feudalism, traditional religious forces, capitalism, the foreign domination of a country. All of those social forces, those are the kind of people the U.S. further empowers and entrenches, and it's precisely those relations and that kind of exploitation and oppression that's responsible for the suffering of the people to begin with and in an even more acute way under conditions of U.S. occupation.
You know, it's really interesting because that's part of it. I mean, even the way that he framed the Karzai government and the way that he was described what he was saying about it, you know, which was actually, this is the legitimately elected or whatever government of the people of Afghanistan. And then this thing, too, about the Taliban. He talked about focusing some stuff on the Taliban, but at the same time, we had Joanne Mariner on the show last week, and she was talking about how in the Military Commissions Act, they just somehow slipped in that the Taliban is no longer considered enemy combatant status. It's actually considered, it's just been taken off the list altogether.
Well, I mean, this shows you two things. I mean, Obama made clear in his speech that he wanted to negotiate with the Taliban or bring in Taliban fighters who were willing, basically, to go along with the United States. Obviously, they're trying to set terms for those conditions by, quote, weakening the Taliban or halting its momentum, as Obama has put it. But that tells you two things. First, the U.S. mission in Afghanistan is not helping the Afghan people. There was not one single mention in that speech of Afghan women at all. And the fact that Obama is perfectly happy to bring in elements of the Taliban shows that he has, that this occupation is not at all about liberating women. It is not at all about changing this patriarchal, traditional kinds of social relations that strangle women and suffocate them. That's fine. He's not demanding the Taliban give up their views on women before he will negotiate them. Not at all. And in fact, the very people the United States has put in power, when I heard Malala Joya speak, and she called them photocopies of the Taliban. In other words, these are people whose program may not be identical to the Taliban, but who represent the same sort of feudal and traditional social relations that give rise to the oppression of women. The other thing I think was interesting also in the speech was that this question of negotiating with the Taliban, trying trying to, and they're even talking about ceding areas of the country to the Taliban, finding local warlords and power brokers. Again, this points to the fact that the United States is trying to stabilize Afghanistan in a basic kind of a way so it does not hurt U.S. geopolitical interests in the whole region. That's their concern, A, by not destabilizing Pakistan or other countries nearby, and B, not further fueling the rise of Islamic radicalism, Islamic fundamentalism, that is an impediment to their efforts to try to maintain U.S. dominance in this area, which, together with the Middle East, has 80% of the world's energy reserves, and is also abuts the U.S.'s two biggest rivals, Russia and China.
Larry, we have about 2 minutes left, and I want to ask you one final question. One of the points that Obama did in his speech that really just chilled my blood was his call for a ratcheting up of the spirit of national unity. When he talked about, when we first began this war, we were tremendously united in a patriotic fervor, and he's called for the renewal of that. Can you talk about that and what that means?
Well, that was blood-curdling. Just think back to that atmosphere of lynch mob hysteria, chauvinism, shutting down any kind of critical thinking or inquiry about why these sorts of attacks would happen, what they meant, what people should do about them, lining people up and giving the Bush regime a blank check for war that is still going on to this day, torture, rendition, and so on and so on. So the idea that Obama would want to recreate that just shows that if you're commander-in-chief of the U.S. empire, you're going to act according to its exigencies and necessities. And they do face tremendous necessities because their power and the functioning of their whole system does rest on global exploitation and global domination. But the people, the masses of people of the world and the people here have no interest in this at all. And we've got to break from this whole framework. And look, whatever you thought about Obama, if you're sickened by this speech, if you don't want this war to go on in Afghanistan, you need to get with World Can't Wait. You need to get with, you know, Revolution Newspaper and so on and resist this war. You know, he gave this speech with the eyes of the whole world watching, and people around the world are going to be wondering, now are the American people, are people in this country finally going to say enough is enough, we're going to stop it? And while people are out in the streets resisting, yes, they do need to be looking at analysis of why this is happening and the nature of this whole system that continues to fight these wars, and how we need, as you were saying at the beginning of the show, a radically, radically different system and a radically different world.
All right, Larry, thank you very much, man. I think actually maybe we should dedicate this show to the people of Afghanistan and the people, especially the revolutionaries and the communist revolutionaries among them, who will stand up and oppose this. And to all the people all around the world, including right here in the belly of this beast, who will stand up and stand with him and oppose what the U.S. is doing and stand with the people that are fighting against it all over the world, especially in Afghanistan and Iraq these days. Larry,
okay,
thank you very
Michael.
Much for joining us. Okay.
Take care.
You too. I want to remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We're talking today with Larry Everest, a journalist with Revolution Newspaper, the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda, and we're talking about Obama's escalation of the criminal war in Afghanistan. We're going to take a short break and be right back with our next segment, Mike Gray and the Murder of Fred Hampton.
You know I heard the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just a life is all I had out in a parade of centuries. People cried out and said, please, please, we want freedom, liberation, and just some help in this civilization. And though I heard the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just a life is all I got. What did they do? What did they say to justify speaking this way, hey, that you fought and often cried, and when they turned around, were shot down and died. Oh, but I heard the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just a life is all I had at Bunchie and John. Walked through this maze, they touched a million lives in a thousand ways, 70. Never knew them, 26 and 23 is all they were. Oh, can't you see, didn't you hear the people say, what will you give in your way? I saw them turn, stop, and listen to the people cry and say, just a life is all I got.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. That was Elaine Brown with a piece called Assassination from her album Seize the Time. Assassination is a song all about the assassination of Bunchie Carter and John Huggins, two Black Panther Party leaders out at UCLA in Los Angeles. And that assassination was carried out by the US organization, the United Slaves Organization, led by Ron Karenga, working together with the FBI. And it was part of an overall assault against Panther members and Panther leaders, against the Black Panther Party, and especially against its leaders at the time. At a very young age, the Panthers were the target of some of the greatest repression, some of the most severe repression ever unleashed against a revolutionary organization in this country. And one of those leaders that was assassinated by, again, the workings of the FBI, working in conjunction with the Chicago police, was Fred Hampton. And we're talking today with Mike Gray, one of the filmmakers and the producer of The Murder of Fred Hampton. This film is a seminal piece on the assassination of Fred Hampton. And Mike was one of the first people, him and his crew, were some of the first people on the scene in the house after the assassination of Fred Hampton. And since we're talking about Fred Hampton and the assassination of Fred Hampton, I thought it'd be good to give you a sense of just who Fred Hampton was. And so before we get into our conversation with Mike Gray, the producer and one of the filmmakers of The Murder of Fred Hampton, I wanted you to hear something that comes at the very end of the film. It's Fred Hampton's voice, and it'll give you a real good sense of who he was.
I want you to know that I want you to see. If you ever think about me, and if you think about me, niggas, and if you ain't gonna do no revolutionary act, forget about me. I don't want myself on your mind if you're not gonna work for the people. Like we always said, if you ask to make a commitment at the age of 20, and you say, I don't want to make that commitment only because for the simple reason that I'm too young to die, I want to live a little bit longer. What you did, you did already.
You have to understand that people have to pay the price for peace. If you dare to struggle, you dare to win. If you dare not to struggle, then goddamn it, you don't deserve to win. Let me say peace to you if you're willing to fight for it. Let me say it in the spirit of liberation. I've been gone for a little while. At least my body's been gone. You ain't got to repeat after me. At least my body's been gone for a little while. But I'm back now, and I believe that I'm back to stay. I believe that I'm going to do my job, and I believe that I was born not to die in a car wreck. I don't believe I'm going to die in a car wreck. I don't believe I'm going to die from slipping on a piece of ice. I don't believe I'm going to die because I got a bad heart. I don't believe I'm going to die because of lung cancer. I believe that I'm going to be able to die what I was in the thing that I was born for. I believe that I'm going to be able to die high off the people. I believe that I will be able to die as a revolutionary in the international revolutionary proletarian struggle. And I hope that each one of you will be able to die in the international proletarian revolutionary struggle, or you didn't be able to live in it. And I think that struggle is going to come. Why don't you live for the people? Why don't you struggle for the people? Why don't you die for the people?
That was the voice of Fred Hampton, from the chairman of the Illinois branch of the Black Panther Party. 40 years ago, on December 4th, 1969, Fred Hampton was murdered, viciously, criminally, savagely murdered, along with Mark Clark. A number of other Panthers were shot. He was murdered by the Chicago police, the FBI, and the American system. And one of the people who was intimately bound up with this whole scene in terms of filming, the film that was actually the statement and remains one of the most powerful films that you're ever going to see about that, the murder of Fred Hampton, is Mike Gray. Mike is the producer of the film. He's one of the filmmakers of it. And Mike is joining us today. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you, Michael?
I'm pretty good, man. I'm pretty good. I was watching the film again last night, and I went back and forth between playing the trailer and playing that speech that you had from those things from Fred at the end of the film, and it's just one of the most powerful moments. I think it really captures a lot about who Fred Hampton was.
Well, as I have said on many occasions, Michael, after doing those two movies, American Revolution 2, which led us to meet Fred Hampton, and then following Hampton for the last 9 months of his life in what came to be the murder of Fred Hampton. And then, of course, shortly after that, I had to leave Chicago in a hurry.
Right.
The police department was encouraging that pretty much, on a minute-by-minute basis. And so I always wanted to check out Hollywood anyway. And as a filmmaker, you've got to get here sooner or later, and I've been here ever since. But my career has taken some unusual turns, and it has been my privilege to meet many famous and powerful people. But I have yet to meet Fred Hampton's equal, and he was 21 when they killed him.
Amazing, man. Amazing. That's a very powerful statement there, Mike. You know, one of the things I think is really interesting is, you started out to make a film about the Panthers.
Well, we started, Michael, by accident, actually. During the Democratic National Convention, I was shooting a television commercial with Colonel Harlan Sanders. We were upwardly mobile businessmen at the time. and Colonel Sanders was in Chicago as a delegate to the Democratic National Convention from the great state of Kentucky. And the ad agency asked us to shoot some footage of the colonel, finger-licking good or whatever, while he was in town. And while we were doing that, we began hearing reports from downtown of a police riot, and we sent the colonel out with our charming and lovely receptionist, Brenda, and told her not to bring him back. and we went down there, and the footage that you have seen probably in films like Eyes on the Prize and others of the Democratic National Convention, where the cops are beating people senseless at the corner of Michigan and Balboa, students and delegates and parents and teachers alike. We shot that footage, and we just happened to arrive at that intersection at that moment and got that had sense enough to turn the cameras on and to run with that footage. And that led us to make a film called American Revolution 2, which has also just been redigitized and re-released by Facets Media. But during the course of filming that fall of 1968, we met Fred Hampton and Howard Alk, who was the perceptive genius behind both movies, and he saw the footage that I had shot of the Democratic Convention and said, "We've got something here. We got to pursue this." And so he then made the contact with Hampton. And once we saw him in action, we said, "This is a movie." And so we never stopped shooting. We finished American Revolution 2. Howard and I were editing that while at the same time we were shooting the beginning of the film that came to be the murder of Fred Hampton.
Now, what was it about Fred Hampton that made you actually make that statement you made in the beginning of the show?
Well, we looked at the footage, endlessly, and when you cut a movie, especially a documentary of this kind, where you have to memorize every frame in order to understand what the material is telling you, you see, you'll see some scene that you particularly are fascinated with maybe a couple of hundred times. Watching all of that going on in the editing machine after Hampton died, we were trying, what was it about this guy that was such a traffic stopper? I mean, people would literally, when he walked into a room, conversation would stop. People would turn to him expectantly before he even opened his mouth. There was some vibe there that he had that just simply stopped people in their tracks and caused folks to follow him. And I finally came to the conclusion that what it was absolute fearlessness. He was Christ-like almost in his fearlessness. In other words, there was nothing you could say to that guy that would shake him up. And no threat, no nothing. He was as not cool, but calm, and in the face of danger, especially calm, and it was remarkable. I mean, it really attracted attention, and it's something that I think what had happened was that Hampton knew that to stake out the position that he was staking out, that they were going to try to kill him, and that he just simply had to face that as a fact. So he had accommodated his own death. The rest of us always, we hope, we're going to make a last-minute deal with the All-One, you know. Give me a pass here just this once. Hampton knew better, and he faced it squarely and with incredible courage.
Well, you know what always struck me about him is the point, yes, there's incredible courage, but the courage was based on something, because the one thing that always came out of him, and every time he talked about two things, being high on the people, but he talked about revolution.
Yeah.
And he was so committed to the idea of revolution and the practice of revolution, that made him absolutely fearless in the face of all these threats.
Yes. Well, one of the things you have to understand, there was a significant difference between Huey Newton and Fred Hampton, and that goes to the very core of their origins. And Huey Newton became a famous public figure, and rightly so. I mean, he certainly was a remarkable young man. But the difference was, Huey's education was basically prison-oriented. In other words, he came from the streets. He knew that world really well, and he understood the street dynamics, and he understood the interplay between the police and the community on a visceral level. And that was his background and his education. Fred Hampton came from a middle-class family, like Che Guevara. In other words, he was very well-educated. He was a leader in high school. When they had a race riot at Proviso East High School, the person they called on, the principals and the administrators, called on this student, who then I think was a junior, if I'm not mistaken, Fred Hamp, to tamp down the crisis. And he did. And he was head of the NAACP youth chapter before he ever even heard of the Panthers. And his parents were hardworking, and they were wonderful people. I was privileged to meet them after the fact and spoke with them. Actually, was at a barbecue in Fred's honor a couple of seasons ago when they dedicated a new monument to him in Chicago. I went back for that, and his parents and I spent a wonderful evening together. And you know, they came from the South, went to Chicago to get jobs, got jobs, worked their tails off, just, you know, the American dream. And they raised a kid who was on his way to law school, and he would have been a hell of an attorney. He would have been a masterful attorney.
But then we wouldn't have had the revolutionary leader that we got at that point, which is, I think...
He made his choice, and mm-hmm. I think that it's important for us to celebrate that choice, because he made quite a difference. He brought down the Daley machine in Chicago. His killing ended the supremacy of Mayor Daley in Chicago. The black community abandoned the Daley machine because of this raid, and brought in the first woman mayor of the city of Chicago, followed immediately by the first black mayor of the city of Chicago. And that flowed directly as a result of the city's involvement in Hampton's assassination.
Well, let me ask you this, Mike, because the other thing that Fred did was he did bring forward, he inspired generations of people around revolutionary thinking and around standing up against this machine, this capitalist machine. You know, the whole idea, this society, the oppression here, he inspired many people to actually take up where he left off. And I want to remind listeners that I'm Michael Slate, and you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. Today we're talking with Mike Gray, one of the filmmakers and the producer of the film The Murder of Fred Hampton. This is sort of the seminal work on the murder of Fred Hampton, a seminal film on the murder of Fred Hampton. Mike was one of the first people on the scene after Fred was murdered by the Chicago police and the FBI back in December 4th, 1969. One of the things that you were in a very remarkable position for is you were making this film about Fred Hampton and the Panthers, and then on December 4th, that morning, you woke up and Fred Hampton had been murdered with Mark Clark, the massive attack on this, the FBI, the police. Can you talk about that some? I mean, there's your...
We had a living in the apartment on North State Parkway across the street from the Cardinals' house. Our apartment had been the living room of a huge mansion that had been cut up into apartments. And my wife Carol and I were asleep. It must have been about 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning. We get a call from the People's Law Office, who represented a group of young white revolutionary attorneys who represented the Panthers and others in that period, and they said, Fred Hampton has been killed. Get your cameras and get out to 2337 West Monroe Street as fast as you can. So I called my production manager, Jim Dennett, who lived way out in Wakanda, and Chuck Olin, who was living actually just down the street from me, and we all met with Howard Alk at the studio, grabbed the gear, threw it into the van, and went out to West Monroe Street, and we were scared to death. I don't mind telling you, because we didn't know what we were going to be facing. We had no idea what had happened, or if the cops were going to be there, if they were going to bust us when we appeared or whatever. Turns out the place had been left unguarded. Now, that has never happened before. The cops in Chicago have been blowing away black people, you know, for a long time without much comment or uprising or whatever, because there was, you know, it was always the crime scene was sealed. This time, the cops were apparently so, it was a special detachment under the auspices of the state's attorney for the Northern District of Illinois, Edward V. Hanrahan. And Hanrahan had been approached by the FBI and asked to stage this raid. The FBI gave him a map of Hampton's apartment that had been sketched by their informant inside Hampton's organization, a man named William O'Neill, who had been a Detroit car thief that was recruited by the Chicago office of the FBI to come to Chicago and join the Panther Party and act as their inside informant. And he visited Hampton's apartment the night of the raid and left several hours before, and there is some evidence that he may have put some kind of a drug in Hampton's meal, because he was there at the time, and Hampton really never woke up during the raid. He lifted his head up at one point, but he died in his bed. And many people believe that O'Neill also gave him some kind of a knockout drug. But when we walked in, it was a disaster. See, there was blood all over the place. There were shotgun shells all over the floor. Every wall had. I mean, these walls were. This was a slum building on West Monroe Street that had been kind of, you know, slightly rebuilt, and it had some drywall separating the bedrooms and stuff like that. Anyhow, and we went into Hampton. There was the bed where Hampton had died, and as we lifted up the mattress, 3.45 caliber machine gun bullets fell out of the mattress. And it was obvious that every shot that the police fired was aimed at that bedroom. They knew that they came to kill Hampton, and they killed him.
Exactly. And Mike, one of the things, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, and one of the things that I think your film also brings out is that this assault, as egregious as it was, as horrifying and enraging as it was, it also, one of the things that you document very well in your film is the response of the Panthers in really going to the people and coming back up against it and really never losing that orientation. Mike, thank you very much for joining us today.
Michael, thank you. And both films, American Revolution 2 and The Murder of Fred Hampton, are available from Facets Multimedia in Chicago. Just Google Facets Media, and they have them available, I think, as a brand new CD or a DVD, high res, that we had completely redigitized.
All right, Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael.
All right, that about wraps it up for today. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm the host and producer of the show, Michael Slate. I want to thank my engineer, Melissa Figueroa. I want to thank Age and Henry for production help, and I want to thank all of you for tuning in, and I really enjoy hearing from you, so if you want to write to me, you can, at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And remember, the world today is crying out for radical change. There is a whole better way we could be and should be living than what we're doing right now. If you listen, that's what you're going to hear. The world is crying out for radical change, and it's up to us, each and every one of us. We're going to go out now with a song that I think is particularly relevant to everything we've been talking about today, one of my favorite songs from one of my favorite musicians, Lily Hayden and the Children of Babylon.
Go on.